WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The number of fatal drug overdoses in New Jersey has risen to more than one per day, and the number of young people in the state who were treated for abusing opiates and heroin has skyrocketed in the past several years. Here with me to discuss their new report are the chair of the task force established by the Governor's Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. His name is Frank Greenagle. He's also a professor at Rutgers and a counselor there, where he oversees the Rutgers Recovery Housing Program. And also joining us is Patty DiRenzo, who lost her son to addiction and is an advocate for substance abuse reforms. Frank, Patty, thank you for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And listeners, we want this to be your segment two. Do you know someone, a friend or family member, who has struggled with a prescription drug or heroin addiction problem in New Jersey or anywhere? Do you want to share your story? These things are on the rise right now, and our guests are trying to figure out why, as well as grappling with their personal grief. Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. Do you know someone who has had a substance abuse addiction but is in recovery, especially for heroin, which is coming back, other kinds of opiates? 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Patty, would you tell us your story? I hate to even ask you to tell us your story again, but how did you get involved with the task force and why?
My son struggled with addiction through his teenage years. He was using marijuana, I guess, you know, just like not every typical, I don't like to say that, but, you know, started out using marijuana and turned to pills. But when the pills became a little bit too expensive, he started using heroin.
Were the pills prescription painkillers?
Yes. Yes.
Because that's one of the reasons that people say heroin is spiking. The prescription painkillers that were the addiction, you know, du jour for a number of years are getting so expensive and heroin is cheaper. Would you say that was an issue in your son's life?
That was absolutely the issue. I mean, when he, you know, the pills on the street, I think, are going for $25 to $30 a pop, but, you know, you buy a bag of heroin for $5. So, you know, what happens is when they can't afford the pills and, you know, they're taking them from their parents' medicine cabinets and they're no longer available, they're turning to the heroin, which is what happened with my son. And, you know, I mean, we tried desperately to get help for him on many occasions. You know, sometimes he would get 7 days here and there, but never got full treatment that he deserved or needed. And most of the places would actually tell us that they wouldn't admit him, A, because his insurance said that he didn't meet the criteria, and because of the fact that he was using heroin, it was not a life-threatening withdrawal. So because of that, they told us that we would need to take him home and detox him ourselves. And once he's detoxed, call back to see if bed's available. But, you know, going through detox with someone who's using heroin very heavily is not a very good sight or something that's easy to do. I don't know if anyone's ever saw the movie Trainspotting, but it's basically the same thing. I mean, we literally held him up in his bedroom, did everything we could, my daughter and I, to get him through detox, and literally sitting on his legs because the cramps were so bad, and rubbing his whole body down with Bengay and giving him Benadryl to try to sleep. But it just, you know, I mean, I'm a single parent. My daughter worked. you know, we had to go to work. Mm-hmm. You know, so the second day we had to leave him home alone, and by the time we got home, he was gone. He was back out on the streets. He couldn't stand the pain anymore, you know, and he was back to using because he could not get that immediate help. And this just went on for years with him, you know, like it was just the same story in and out of emergency rooms and being, you know, handed the sheet of paper with numbers to call and being told the same story that there's no beds, no funding. You know, he doesn't meet criteria. It's exhausting for a family to go through when they have a child struggling with heroin addiction. It's extremely exhausting.
So sorry for your loss and your struggle before your loss. And you advocated last year for the passage of a Good Samaritan law in New Jersey. How is that relevant to what happened to your son and to try to save some people for the future?
Yeah. Well, what had happened was in June of 2010, Sal came to us again, begging us for help. We took him right to the emergency room, and again, we're told the same story. You know, they flushed the system out, gave us that list of phone numbers, and said, can't take him, go home and call these numbers. We spent the whole night calling every single number. And when you're over 18 years old, you, the user, has to make those calls yourself. You know, and it's very hard for somebody when they're starting to go through withdrawal to have, you know, to want to do that. You know, they're frustrated, they're hurting, they're angry, you know, but we begged him and, you know, he was doing it, he was making the calls, but, you know, we were hitting dead ends with everybody, that, you know, no beds available, no funding, and we didn't know what to do. So, you know, my daughter and I sat up and we're thinking, how are we going to get him help? You know, we're going to lose him. So we decided that if we had him call back and say he was drinking alcohol, maybe that would change things. So we had him do that, and once he said that, the facility said, call us back at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and most likely we will have a bed for him. We woke him up at 8. He called. They said, come in. We have a bed. We gave him alcohol, a bottle of vodka, told him to drink it, and they took him right in under county funding, put him in a bed. And we were just elated because, in our mind, we had finally got him the help he needed. But
so it's for funding and accessibility to treatment, but also so somebody who's with a person having a heroin overdose or another illegal drug overdose, so that the person who reports it to try to save that person's life doesn't have to fear getting in trouble with the law?
Exactly. Well, what had happened was, after Sal was released 7 days into that program because his county funding ran out. So they released him, came home. We got him into IOP, which was just 3 nights a week, but he was going and he was doing very well. During the time of going through IOP, he had relapsed. And on September 23rd, the police had came to my door at 2 in the morning to tell me that they found Sal of an overdose in the car, in his car in Camden, and that the evidence showed that there was definitely somebody who was with him at the time of his overdose. So that didn't sit well with me, and that's when I started making calls, and I found the Drug Policy Alliance, and they told me about 911 Good Samaritan laws in other states and asked me if I would be interested in advocating with them, to which I jumped right on that bandwagon, because nobody should be left alone to die. You know, everyone deserves a second chance. And even more so.
And this law did pass in Trenton last year, and so at least you can say you did something so Sal's death was not in vain.
Exactly, exactly.
Let me bring in our other guest who's been waiting patiently, Frank Greenagel, who is the chair of the task force established by the Governor's Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. They just released a report. Professor Greenagel, thanks a lot for coming on. You heard Patty's heartbreaking story. What are you recommending to the governor be done now?
Well, Brian, we have 18 recommendations, and obviously we don't have the time to go through them all. And so the four of the biggest ones are mandating the prescription drug monitoring program, which was actually mandated in New York State in August of last year. We want to take it a little bit further. We also proposed to the legislature to hold some hearings about insurance reforms, because Patty and her family story is just extremely common, and that insurance companies will deny coverage or they'll pay for a lower level of care than is clinically and medically recommended, or if someone does get treatment, that treatment is cut short in the middle of it. We also recommend expanding recovery support. New Jersey, we spend so much money sending kids to treatment programs, whether it's in-state or more likely out-of-state, and then they come home and they go back to right to the same high schools. So one of our proposals is to have a recovery high school. There are people that have been working to have a recovery high school in New York City for years, too, and haven't been able to get that. And you just think how ludicrous it is to send a kid to treatment who's 17 years old, and you spend anywhere from $10,000 to $60,000, whether it's private money or insurance money, and then have them come back to the same high school with the same kids and the same drugs in the same hallways. We also recommend more recovery support programs at colleges. And then another one that's important to me is more and better medication-assisted therapy to help people detox and slowly come off heroin and other opiates.
What is that medication-assisted therapy? Is that what do you call it? I forgot the name of the – is that Naloxone?
So now naloxone is the drug that we give to people to when they're overdosing. The drugs that I think we need for medication assisted therapy is really either going to be Suboxone or Subutex, or a non opiate version of that is Vivitrol, which is injectable naltrexone, which cuts down cravings and the how much it affects someone, and there's been very good numbers with both of those. Although sometimes
Suboxone
can be abused.
You would actually have people inject themselves with something as a step toward getting off heroin.
Well, with Vivitrol, they wouldn't inject it themselves. They'd have to go to a doctor once a month. You know, years ago, there was something – naltrexone was available in a pill. It still is, called Revia. And people would take it for either heroin or alcohol. But you'd have to take it every day. And the idea behind that, though, you know, is a bit flawed in that if I know I want to drink or use drugs, I don't take the pill that day. Whereas if I get a shot, that shot's good for a month. And even if I change my mind at some point and want to get high, that cuts down the craving and it cuts down the effectiveness of taking alcohol or opiates.
John in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Firstly, to your last caller, before the professional, my sympathy goes out. I'm incredibly sorry for a loss. And actually, what you just brought up, as far as naltrexone, I'm calling because I am a recovering heroin addict. I've been clean for just about a year now.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
And naltrexone was actually one of the medications that helped me to stay clean. I actually didn't go the injection route. I went the route of just taking a pill every single day. But it really was incredibly effective in helping to cut down cravings. And knowing that it just blocked the ability to use opiates was enough to help me get through it.
Having been there and now back for a year, what would you say needs to be done to stem the tide of the heroin addiction epidemic that seems to be rising in New Jersey as well as elsewhere, or in addition to what you've been taking to treat people?
Honestly, if I had an answer to that, you know, I'd be a very lucky man. But it seems almost impossible to stop this trend now that it's already started. You know, I think what we have to work on now is plans for recovery. It's I'm only 23 years old, and I started using opiates recreationally when I was very young, as did almost all of my peer group. So it has been growing for a long time.
How did it even happen?
With prescription painkillers, as we said, and then moved on to heroin as heroin got cheaper and pills got more expensive, and
may I ask, John,
no way to turn that back now, but what we have to focus on is getting the right recovery programs in place and making them more accessible.
How did it even happen, if I may ask, in your peer group as teenagers, I guess, that heroin became a thing, an acceptable thing that people were doing instead of something to totally avoid and be deathly afraid of?
You know, it's funny. I was just discussing it with my mother, who grew up in the 60s, and she said, you know, back in my day, we used to do all this kind of stuff, but, even as crazy as we were, that was the one thing that nobody would touch. But in, you know, in the group of, like, I'd say 16 to 25-year-olds nowadays, it's so common and accepted that you don't even give it a second thought. It started with most people getting access to painkillers through their parents, you know, either stealing them from their parents or, you know, somebody would, it would start off as simply as, you know, somebody would be playing football in high school and they'd get an injury and they would get a prescription for Oxycontin or some kind of equivalent. And slowly but surely it would seep its way out from, you know, what it was intended for and into the recreational community. And before you know it, you had kids in high school who were, you know, selling pills in the bathroom and taking them in class. I had seen kids snort pills in class when I was still a sophomore in high school.
Wow.
I won't mention what high school that was, but I've talked to people from other high schools, and they said they've had very similar experiences.
John, thank you for being so open with us. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
So, Frank Greenagle, how do you take a story like John's and turn it into a recommendation for state policy?
Brian, the scary thing is that I've heard that story hundreds of times, and more often than not, it ends badly. That caller is one of the lucky few who came out on the other end. So, you know, he talked about, you know, it was fantastic the way he described it because, you know, heroin has always been the biggest and scariest of substances that people can take. And even people that are abusing, you know, cocaine or using marijuana every single day or, you know, drinking themselves to death, you know, when they were offered heroin, they say, no, I'm not interested in that. And what prescription painkillers did was it opened the marketplace to a whole new group and class of people who never would have tried heroin, but they were willing to try the same chemical in a pill form that was advertised as safe, pure, and legal. And so by mandating the prescription drug monitoring program, we cut down on the new access to opiates. We make it much more difficult for diversion to happen, cut down on the number of prescriptions out there, but not to get rid of it. It's such the knee-jerk reaction to say, well, we've got to get rid of all pain pills. Pain pills absolutely work. My mom recently broke her arm, and so she's taking a very low dose of a Percocet, and that seems to be helping her very well without giving her the euphoric effects. And so in no way are we saying let's get rid of painkillers. What we are saying is let's cut down on the number of prescriptions that are being given and the amount of pills that are given in prescriptions. And the only way we can do that is if we have a prescription drug monitoring program with some teeth.
Rufus in Rockland County, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rufus.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to offer anecdotally, well, I guess an observation, but maybe a question. You know, it seems to me that the first wave of people I knew of who discussed heroin addiction, you know, perhaps before I met them, had to do with the Vietnam era. And it was people coming back from Southeast Asia and from Vietnam. And then we had the crack epidemic, which seems, at least anecdotally, to sort of coincide with our military incursions in Latin America. And I was just wondering, when I first saw we were going into Afghanistan, I thought, well, how long is it going to take for cheap heroin to hit the streets in New York City? What's going to be the turnaround time on this?
So, Frank Greenagle or Patty DiRenzo, if you have an opinion on this, is there any correlation in your opinion?
You know, I am trying to. That's actually too much of a global macro level for me. I'm really much more concerned with, you know, prevention and treatment and recovery support. And I think that we go down a rabbit hole if we're looking at too much at the global geopolitics of this.
Michelle in Wappingers Falls, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Brian. I don't know how much I can add to this very sad conversation that you guys are having today, but definitely it needs to be had. I'm also in recovery from heroin addiction, and, you know, Suboxone has worked for me. Methadone has worked for me at different times. It's the pharmaceutical companies, you know, that are taking the use today. It's all about them making money. You know, they push pain pills. People, parents put them in their cabinets. Children go into the cabinets. They take them, and that's how they get into the schools. I mean, I don't really know if I have any solution except, like the gentleman said, to focus on recovery. And the recovery high school sounded fantastic to me.
Michelle, thank you very much. Well, your report, Frank, recommends working with the pharmaceutical industry in New Jersey, which, of course, is huge. Is the industry interested in working with the prevention and treatment community? Or can you even lay as much blame at, you know, the foot of their doorstep for being greedy? They are producing legal and very needed products here. Do you point to pharmaceutical industry greed at all, as the caller does?
You know, I'll give a short answer, and then I'll let Patty address that, you know, because, you know, we have to come up with a coalition, and we have to get as many people involved in as possible. And so, you know, there is plenty of blame to go around. But if I go around railing against pharmaceutical companies or insurance companies, that's not going to solve the problem. We need to bring them to the table. And our attorney general's office and some other lawyers, you know, that work in government have talked to the prescription drug companies about helping fund some of the things we're talking about. And so as long as we have a dialogue, it may not be the dialogue that I eventually want to totally have, but it's a starting point, and you know, and so that's all much better news than we had 1 or 2 years ago.
Patty, you want to get in on this?
Yes, I agree. I feel like the pharmaceutical companies definitely need to step up to the plate and help us. Maybe give us grants towards naloxone kits. You know, I mean, we need money to purchase more naloxone kits. You know, the bill was signed in May of 2013. You know, and we still don't have EMTs or first responders carrying naloxone yet. You know, there's still so many barriers. And if, you know, we need the funding. I mean, that's a big problem. The pharmaceutical companies have plenty of funds that they can help us fund these programs. They could help us with PSAs. You know, I mean, we need help advertising. We need help letting everyone know about this epidemic because we are definitely losing a generation of children, and doctors need to be responsible too. I mean, I literally just broke my foot 2 weeks ago and went to the urgent care, and as I was walking out, the doctor didn't even question my background. He just handed me a prescription that was pre-printed for Percocet, and I thought, are you kidding me? You know, I don't understand that. You know, I mean, it's something has to stop.
So, Patty, you already got one piece of legislation through Trenton, partly with your efforts, that Good Samaritan law. What's the next thing that needs to be done, in your opinion, as we start to wrap up this conversation? If there was one thing at a policy level that you would be pushing for next, what would it be?
What I'm pushing for right now is education. Education in a broader sense. Trying to get, you know, word out about the 911 law. You know, we have now, I think, 13 billboards across New Jersey that have been donated by billboard companies advertising the 911 bill. And, you know, I mean, naloxone, so we need to get that in the hands of family members, those struggling, you know, first responders. You know, we need to save lives. You know, this is huge. We have an epidemic and we need to save lives.
Frank, a last word.
You know, I get asked the question a lot, what can ordinary citizens do? And so this is for most of your listeners out there. And the 4 points I would ask you are secure your medicine cabinet. Everyone should go home, go into their medicine cabinet and see what's in there and either, you know, dispose of the pills properly or lock them up. And if you think that, you know, my kid's not doing it or I have a great babysitter and they're not going through their medicine cabinet, you know, maybe you're right. But if you're wrong, the price is incalculable. We'd like to see a prescription drop box in almost every town so people can, you know, drop off prescription drugs, and, you know, because we really don't want them flushed down the toilet. It's much better to drop them off and secure them. We'd like to push for, you know, curriculum in schools, you know, middle schools and high schools to have prescription drug training because, you know, a lot of kids get talked to about alcohol and other substances, but they're not talked to about prescription drugs. And the way people can make these changes is call their local politicians at the municipal county or even state assembly people or state senators and let them know that they care about this. You know, they often don't hear from their constituents, and so just a couple of phone calls can make a world of difference.
My guests have been Frank Greenagle, the chair of the task force that's part of the New Jersey Governor's Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Their report is just out. He's also a professor and counselor at Rutgers, where he also oversees the Rutgers Recovery Housing Program. And Patty DiRenzo, after the loss of her son, now an advocate for substance abuse reform. Thank you both so much for having this important conversation with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay with us.